Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The American Psychiatric Association is considering modifying the definition of autism. It's a move that could affect hundreds of thousands of families across the country, and there's been a dramatic increase in the numbers of children diagnosed with autism over the past two decades. Experts say the new standards would likely narrow those numbers. Joining me now to discuss the autism debate within the context of Utah is Dr. William McMahon. He is chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and a professor of psychiatry, pediatric psychology, and educational psychology at the University of Utah's School of Medicine. His current research focuses on the genetics of autism. And Dr. McMahon, thanks very much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
Later on in the program, the Million Veterans Project and why Uncle Sam wants DNA from veterans. But first, autism. Are you following the reclassification debate? And would your child's diagnosis change under a new definition of autism? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. McMahon, before we get into the current controversy about redefining autism, maybe describe for us what we currently know about this disorder, the behaviors associated with autism.
I would compare autism and our understanding of it today to perhaps the way we as a society understood fever in the 1900s or earlier than that. It appears that autism is a collection of disorders, not a single disorder, and that we're able to discriminate autism from non-autism pretty well by focusing on behaviors and on developmental history. However, it's likely that many genes contribute to the causation of autism, and that different genes in different families and different biochemical pathways are involved in different cases. So we're currently not able to discriminate at a molecular level or at the sort of brain function level of subtypes of autism. So instead, we just depend on behavioral descriptions, and we're getting better at that, but this current controversy is really a long-standing thing. It's not just current. There are historical roots.
So the research is focusing on the genetic component that, it tends to run in families, but we really don't know physiologically what's happening in the body and the mind of an autistic person.
Well, from a genetics perspective, we've identified many genes that seem to be important in individual cases, and it's likely we'll find more. So currently, there are probably at least 100 genes that could be called candidate genes for autism. Most of them involve the connections of neurons one to another at what's called the synaptic cleft, that is the junction between one brain cell and another, and the genes that help develop the architecture of the electrical system in the brain are genes that have been found to be involved. However, there are other classes of genes that have also been found in other cases. So it's a really complicated story. I would probably compare it to something like, say, epilepsy or to intellectual disability, where we know there are many genes and we're able to define behavior, for example, with intellectual disability by testing IQ. But we know there are many different causes.
Mm-hmm. Who gets autism? Boys, girls, anyone?
Well, like most developmental disorders, boys are at a higher risk, and usually the rate is somewhere around 4 to 1, although the recent study last year found in Utah, boys were even more than 4 to 1. I think it was 8 to 1. Mm. But that's probably a function of different samples and sampling biases or just the luck of the draw when you try to estimate prevalence from less than a full sample.
And when do the symptoms of autism manifest themselves? Is it right at birth we know that this child is going to be facing some developmental issues, or is it a little bit later?
It's usually not at birth. And it also depends on the experience of the parents with child development, because parents who have had several children or who have grown up in families with younger children and have watched children develop developmental milestones are better observers than parents who have never observed infants. Nevertheless, it looks like more than half are available for diagnosis. That is, we could make a reliable diagnosis somewhere around the first birthday, and that some cases of autism actually develop a little bit after the first birthday. In the new diagnostic classification, I believe that the age requirement currently at 36 months to qualify for the diagnosis of autism, that requirement for a specific age of onset will be eliminated. And I think the reason that will be eliminated is we're now recognizing autism in adults, and they're not very good reporters of how they were at ages infancy to 3 years.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. William McMahon. He's chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. And we're talking about a proposal to redefine what autism is. If you have questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Also joining us this hour, Dr. Pete Nicholas. He is the director of Valley Mental Health's Carmen B. Pingree Center for Children with Autism. He has a PhD in educational psychology, and he's joining us by phone from his office. And Dr. Nicholas, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the early symptoms of autism, how it seems to manifest itself in very young children. I'm wondering about the children that you see at the Pingree Center, and what are some of the behaviors that you notice on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the children at Pingree would be, you know, from about roughly ages 2 to all the way through elementary school and young adolescents. The types of behaviors that kids are most often referred for by pediatricians and families would be, you know, some of the main characteristics of autism: lack of communication skills, lack of being able to attend and follow directions. Some, as the children get older, we have some other behaviors that they've learned how to cope within their environment, and that can be aggressive or loud or strange behaviors or many different things that are associated with autism. Also, a big one for children is a social unrelatedness. They often are described as being off in their own world, and it's hard to break in unless they have some very intensive training.
Over the past 15 years or so, there's been a real boom in autism diagnoses. Here in Utah, I understand the rate has doubled in just 6 years, from 2002 to 2008. Dr. Nicholas, what's going on here?
Well, we don't know exactly what's going on. We certainly do see a huge increase in numbers of kids being referred. Part of that has been attributable to much more expertise in looking for different behaviors and seeing them and being able to early identify what those behaviors are. Part of been the spectrum of diagnostic categories that are in our diagnostic and statistic manual that we now can look at instead of one tight autistic classical autistic definition. Others have been people wondering about how different environmental effects might increase the numbers of children with autism that may be genetically predisposed and just are waiting for that environmental trigger to be pulled.
Mm. Dr. McMahon?
Yes. Utah has had a rich history in contributing to understanding of autism. Back in the middle 1980s, say from 1984 84 to 88. We participated with Ed Ritvo at UCLA. He was a world expert in autism at the time, and found all cases of autism that met the criteria of that day. That was back in DSM-3 times. And we found a rate of 4 per 10,000 among 8-year-old boys. What we're now talking about are rates of somewhere between 1 in 150 to 1 in 77, so hovering around 1%. Mm. And we're, in order to address the question of is there an increase in the rate over this period of time, or are we just getting better at finding them? There's a really important study done in England last year, published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, that looked at adults in the community, and it was looking at a number of different psychiatric disorders, but one of them was autism. The authors found a rate of 1%, that is, 1 in 100 adults qualify for today's DSM-4 criteria for autism. And so that 1% number is about what we're finding in studies of children. So to me, that means we're really getting much better at defining the disorder. And so far, we have not been able to find any environmental trigger exact cause of what might be increasing prevalence. On the other hand, we do know that cases that were part of our UCLA study back in 1984 that did not meet the criteria of the day back then, we've now reviewed 160 of those cases, and we find that about 65% of them meet today's criteria for autism. Mm. So that tells me that the criteria have gotten broader, and part of the reason for that is that we're better at recognizing milder cases. We used to consider autism a disorder associated with intellectual disability or mental retardation. And now we know many people with good jobs and good educations may have autism, and it may account for their social difficulties, but they're otherwise very functional.
We're speaking with Dr. William McMahon, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Pete Nicholas, director of the Valley Mental Health Carmen B. Pingree Center for Children with Autism. And we're talking about autism. If you have questions or comments, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. And Shauna has been waiting patiently in West Jordan. Shauna, hi.
Hi. I have studied this somewhat, and of course I'm not an expert, but I do have just four quick questions, if I could get those addressed, and then I'll let you guys go at it.
Okay.
One is the autism, is there autism in members of the fundamentalists, you know, the ones in southern Utah that do not vaccinate? Is there any autism that's showing up among the polygamous groups down there that don't?
Is your concern that autism may be linked with vaccination?
Yeah, well, in somewhat, yes.
Okay.
But why are we number one in the nation? That's upsetting. There's got to be a reason. And are we using a different vaccine, perhaps, here? Less individual, more of the, you know, where it's all in the same bottle. Also, there's a plant out in the desert that I believe produces mercury, and they found a lot of mercury in some of our lakes and in the fish they were talking about 2 years ago. Whatever that environmental situation is, could that be having a bearing?
Okay. Shauna, thanks very much for those questions. Let's talk about vaccinations first. I believe that there was an extensive study done a number of years ago that showed some sort of correlation, and that has been discredited. Dr. McMahon?
So there have actually been 12 international studies looking at rates of autism prevalence and rates of vaccination testing the question of whether increasing rates in vaccination lead to increasing rates in autism or the converse, that decreasing rates of vaccination lead to less autism. And the studies are unanimous in finding no correlation between rates of vaccination and rates of autism. And there's one in Japan that was particularly important because what happened in Japan is there was initially, well, in the early 90s, there was nearly 100% vaccination. And then within this one district, large area with a large population, the rates of vaccination went down and significantly. But what was found is the rates of autism just kept going up. Mm. So that's a very important study. The specific question Shauna asked about fundamentalists and autism, well, for a number of reasons, the fundamentalist community are not really hooked in with the healthcare system that allows for record keeping. But at one point, I was doing research on another condition in the communities along the border with Arizona. And I visited there for about 10 years, and I saw autism there at about the same rate that I saw it in the rest of Utah. Then to address the question of our high rates in Utah, the CDC in the first network study of 14 different states found the rates of autism at that time to be about 1 in 150. And Utah's rate was really about average with the 14 states. At the time, the highest state was New Jersey. New Jersey is remarkable for having lots of services for autism and a good network of sharing intelligence, medical intelligence between clinics and the state. Utah has really developed with the help of the Department of Health and with the Utah Registry for Autism and Developmental Disabilities, a program whose director is in our department. Her name is Judy Zimmerman. But we have developed in Utah a really great system for capturing cases and reviewing records. And I would say what the increasing rate has reflected in Utah is at least in part our improved ability to find cases and to count them. So we don't have evidence that there are any environmental triggers.
Not even mercury, as Shauna had, had asked about.
Mercury is a very, very important compound to understand because it is a neurotoxin. But there are two large epidemiologic studies in other countries, one in Japan and one in the Seychelles Islands, where there were incredible high levels of mercury, and a great deal of medical study went into the populations. And in both places, while there were lots of bad effects of mercury, autism was not one of those effects. Mm-hmm. So I would not argue mercury is a good thing. I'm arguing that it's a bad thing, but that it's not a particular cause of autism.
Can I add a little something on that as well?
Sure. Very quickly, we need to go to a break. Dr.
Okay.
Nicholas?
At the Pingree Center, the interesting thing was for our parents was being on pins and needles, whether to inoculate or whether not to. And most of them chose to inoculate, keep their fingers crossed, is the way one parent expressed it to me. But the reality is when that research was debunked, that it was mentioned earlier, it was great relief amongst the parents here at the Pingree Center. There was such relief to feel like, oh my gosh, I've been worried under this huge cloud of doubt of whether I was doing the right thing for my child. And so I think our parents here at the center were greatly relieved.
Mm. Dr. Pete Nicholas is director of Valley Mental Health's Carmen B. Pingree Center for Children with Autism. Also with us in studio, Dr. William McMahon, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. And we're talking about autism. If you'd like to join us, the number is 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. What is autism? Well, a panel of the American Psychiatric Association is considering a redefinition of the disorder, causing debate and some worry for parents and advocates. What would a redefinition mean here in Utah, where one in 49 eight-year-old boys has been diagnosed with autism? If your child has autism, are you following the debate? What are your questions or concerns? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joining us this hour, Dr. William McMahon. He is chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Pete Nicholas, director of Valley Mental Health's Carmen B. Pingree Center for children with autism, joining us by phone. And let's go back to the phones, and George has been patiently waiting in Salt Lake. George, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Great. So I have a son with autism. He's 17 years old now and has actually been a part of the autism research project up at the U since he was about three. He's very high functioning, and I'm wondering if this new classification might bump him into the Asperger's category, or if Asperger's and autism are synonymous, just a higher functioning level of one or the other, of autism.
George, it's a great question. I think a lot of people are sort of pondering this question exactly. Dr. McMahon, maybe you can walk us through what autism is currently defined as. George had mentioned Asperger's. That's part of the spectrum of what autism is. But what are the different levels, and how would the new redefinition change that?
So the current definition was published first in 1994. So the revision is due to come out in 2013. So it'll be 19 years since the revision in a full way of the diagnostic criteria. And currently, to have autism, you have to have symptoms in three different areas of function. One is social interactions, such as back and forth kind of conversations, or play, or eye contact, peekaboo, waving bye-bye, blowing kisses. The second is in language area, and children with autism often develop speech late, but once they develop speech, they often have very unusual tone of voice, very stilted or awkward phrases. Some of them become, as they age, they become really hyperverbal and engage in very long monologues, so that you can't really have a conversation because you just have to sit there and listen to the monologue. And then the third area has to do with repetitive behaviors and restricted interests. So high-functioning individuals with autism may be world experts in very narrow areas of knowledge, such as train schedules throughout the world, or airport architecture, or various biological classifications, or software. So those are the three main areas. A person has to have six symptoms distributed throughout those three areas, and it has to have onset before 36 months of age, that is 3 years, and it can't be due to known causes of a brain malformation or intellectual disability like Fragile X syndrome or some other brain malformation or dysfunction syndromes. So that's the current definition. What's going to happen is that in 2013, there will be this publication of the DSM-5, and it will put together the categories. Right now, for example, Asperger's is a in the broad umbrella of pervasive developmental disorders, and autism is sort of the main pervasive developmental disorder, Asperger's will go away. Asperger's appears to be indistinguishable from autism once you get beyond the age of language development. So
it will be classified as autism, period.
Yes. So the new category will be called autism spectrum disorders. And the word spectrum means there's a broad range of function and symptoms. And it goes back to what I said earlier, that I think we should start viewing autism not as a single disorder, but as a collection of many disorders that may have different molecular and brain function kind of deficits. So again, I use the analogy like fever. There are lots of causes of fever, and we're just judging the surface of what autism is by classifying behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nicholas, I imagine that George's concern is one that you hear often at the Carmen B. Pingree Center. Since it will be the autism spectrum, will children currently diagnosed with Asperger's, for instance, be part of your school population?
Well, you know, frankly, our program really is geared more towards children who are more on the autism or the pervasive developmental, not otherwise specified categories. We don't have too many kids with Asperger's at the Valley Mental Health Pingree Center, and that's simply because as they're younger and language is a big definition for the difference between the diagnoses. A lot of the kids with Asperger's need probably more social interaction with peers that are also, in the same ballpark with maybe deficits in language skills and communication skills. Where we at the Pingree Center are working on core skills like learning how to follow directions and to attend and to learn language skills and be able to start using either nonverbal or verbal skills. So probably at the Pingree Center, we won't notice too much difference with Asperger's. But I want to also add, the one part where we do have kids with Asperger's is on the other two criteria scales, on the behavior. And that's really important to look at. Even with our current classification system, sometimes we get kids that would not qualify for classical autism diagnosis. But their behavior with the criteria that they do meet is severe. Hmm. And so those are the kinds of kids that we would get that might be affected. And those, I hope that we'd still be able to look at, obviously, the behaviors that come along with however many criteria are met.
We're speaking with Dr. Pete Nicholas, director of Valley Mental Health's Carmen B. Pingree Center for Children with Autism. Also with us, Dr. William McMahon, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and a professor of psychiatry, pediatric psychology, and educational psychology at the University of Utah. We're talking about a controversial redefinition of what autism is. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And we'll go back to the phones. Brandy's been waiting in West Jordan. Brandy, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if autism is going to be associated, I know that they're going to be doing the different levels of autism, but is Asperger's going to be associated with that? Is it going to be the same, or is it just going to be the same? Like, this is Asperger's and this is autism.
Hmm. Okay.
Are they going to incorporate Asperger's into autism?
Okay. Dr. McMahon, you addressed that sort of earlier, but...
So the answer is yes, that Asperger's and autism will be folded into this broader category called autism spectrum disorders, and the proposed new DSM-5 criteria will also allow for better specificity of functional impairments, that is, being able to define on a separate axis or with separate descriptors how severe the language or social or everyday living activities might be impaired by the disorder. We all know of famous people who have been very successful in life. Temple Grandin was mm-hmm. just in Utah and received a Lifetime Achievement Award, the Peak Award. She's a famous person with autism who's got a PhD in animal behavior and is a world expert on how to organize feedlots and slaughterhouses and various aspects of the meatpacking industry. There are others who have gone public. Tim Page is a music critic. He worked for the Washington Post and I believe has a different job now, but he's a famous man who's been able to function relatively well. And so he would have autism, but he's not very impaired. And so I would compare autism and the development of this new criteria sort of to depression, where some people can be a little bit depressed and other people can be suicidal and unable to get out of bed or able to function. And I think the autism spectrum diagnosis is a good thing in that respect.
Brandy, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. We'll go to Denoris from Salt Lake City, who has a question. Denoris, hi.
Hi. My question is for the doctors is that I've noticed, I've worked with people with autism, and I noticed in 1998, the Somali community in Minnesota have overrepresented with cases of autism, even still to this day. And as a result of that, of course, they are linking it to the environment because it was mostly non-existent in their native country of Somali. But now it's overrepresented even higher than it is in Utah, the incidence of autism. And I wondered if the doctors had any input or had they heard anything about why that is so in Minnesota.
Okay. Denoris, good question. The concentration of autism, not just in families, but in communities like Somali refugees. Dr. Nicholas, any insight on that?
Boy, I don't know anything about that study.
Okay.
I have to punt.
All right. Dr. McMahon.
I don't know about the Minnesota population, but in Britain, there have been studies of immigrants, and early studies indicated not just Somalis, but other immigrants have a higher level or higher rate of autism. And it's not clear why, and it hasn't always been reproduced in other studies of other populations. So it's one of the many mysteries that are still in front of us regarding autism and its causes.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I understand that it's important to get early detection, that early diagnosis and early intervention. Dr. Nicholas, why is that so important?
Oh, it's just behaviorally, if you get a child early at 2 or even 3 or 4, there's less history in terms of adopting behaviors that they've used. They're less ingrained. And so then you have a better chance of starting to teach children a better way of handling things within their family, within their community, within school settings. It's just, generally speaking, a lot easier to be able to teach new skills at a younger age. If you're older, then the skills that you have used have been reinforced over years of using, and then it becomes much more difficult to make the impact. It's not impossible. It still can be done, but it takes a lot more intensive work to do that than when you have a young child.
I want to squeeze in one final call from Mark in Salt Lake City. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Your question or comment?
Yes, I have a quick comment. I have a 17-year-old autistic son, and at the time he was diagnosed, we were living in California, and my wife happened to be pregnant at the time, and we went in to see a geneticist because that's what our health care insurance recommended, and I'll make this quick, but the geneticist didn't know we were expecting another child. And we had a very traumatic experience because the geneticist said we should not have any more children. Mm-hmm. And then we told her, my wife was pregnant. She said we should have an abortion and not have any more children. And because of our religious beliefs, we chose not to. And we ended up having, you know, three more children that are not autistic. And I think it's, in my opinion, you know, that's one reason why in Utah there are such great studies, because generally families tend to have more children, even if they have an autistic child. Whereas in California, we knew many families that would stop having children as soon as they had an autistic child. So I just wanted to share that comment, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Mark, thanks so much for the call. Thoughts on Mark's story, Dr. McMahon?
Well, that's a very important story to get out, that we're not good at predicting what happens to subsequent children. We know in general risks are higher. And what Mark said about Utah and the population of Utah having more children, and particularly having children after having an handicapped children, that's really true. And it's given us the ability to study this phenomena called stoppage by the geneticists, I think, better than is elsewhere. What I can say is the risk is higher if there's one child born with autism, somewhere in the range of 20% empirically. But we are not yet able to dissect out more specific risks, except in those conditions where there might be fragile X or a few rare genetic mutations. So the state of the art is still pretty fuzzy.
Mm. Mark, thanks for sharing that story. I just have one final question. As the experts are reconsidering the definition of what autism is, and now it looks like it's going to be something of a spectrum, if it's truly a spectrum, can you progress off of the grid? You know, can you outgrow autism? And as you were talking, Dr. Nicholas, it just made me think that if you can make improvements in your behaviors from a very young age, is this something that you can outgrow, Dr. Nicholas?
Well, unfortunately, autism is a lifelong disability at this point. However, having said that, there are some families, many families, who can certainly improve outcomes based on the interventions that they get involved with their children. And the best one that's most replicated and has really good outcomes is behavioral interventions, applied behavioral analysis. It works. It works enough that it will help a child fit into various environments that they couldn't do without that kind of intervention.
Pete, if I could add, you know, from our follow-up study of the children we found in the 1980s, we've now done assessments on over 150 of these individuals over 20 years later. So they're adults. And we found about five people who no longer meet criteria for autism as adults, whereas they did as children. And we have asked them to go public and to talk about what helped them. But our best efforts at this point have not borne fruit, in that people are still afraid of discrimination in the workplace or in the neighborhood. So the issue of outgrowing or developing beyond the autism spectrum seems to be possible, and we don't understand it well enough now to say much more about it, but we are studying it.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. William McMahon, Chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Utah, and Dr. Pete Nicholas, Director of Valley Mental Health's Carmen B. Pingree Center for Children with Autism. Thanks very much for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Up next, details on the Million Veteran Project, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.